So like I said earlier, I'm Aaron. Doing an intro is sort of weird. Like, hey, it's my wife. I'm not 12. Cool. I've been going to Mosaic for a few years. I came here kind of burnt out, which is kind of a typical story, I guess, with Mosaic. And Tony made me sit up there. Jasmine and I sat up there for years, and we, well, not years, like months, and we weren't allowed to do anything. I've been teaching since I was 15, which has been really bad for me, but sitting up there was really good for me. So I might just sit up there. But I've been around for a while. I think this morning I got a Facebook notification that said 3 years ago, on this day, I actually taught this service. And I don't recognize hardly any of you. You were there. I actually met you, Ron, on that. So, you know, 3 years ago, all the people that you meet, you don't remember me? Damn. All right, so what have we been talking about? What? Yeah, we've been talking about love. We've been talking about kind love in the context of what? How do we have a kind love for other people? By recognizing our poverty, right? Did Tony cover this on Saturday? Because here's what Tony does. He's like, yeah, Saturday was just like Sunday. Does this sound familiar that we're talking about how we have to recognize our own poverty? And that by recognizing our own poverty, that we're able to love kindly, recognizing that we have weaknesses, therefore we're able to bear the burdens of weaknesses in others. Yeah, okay. So I'm continuing on from there. So do you have notes? How many of you don't have notes? Because unlike Tony, I'm gonna use these. If you have the YouVersion app, you're cool. But otherwise, you're gonna need one of these. Does anyone need one of these? No, we're good? Awesome. Okay, so I'm just going to read it. Okay, so it says, do not hold back, instead give. As we seek to remember our frailty, our poverty, and the gentle kindness of our God who cares for us indiscriminately, that is, without being partial, we begin to understand how we ought to love those around us, to honor them and love them as we love ourselves. As we begin to pray, for eyes to see, for ears to hear, for hearts to empathize, ooh, nice, typo, wisdom to discern and eyes to invite, hands to extend and stuff to give, our hearts begin to beat in sync with the heart of our Father. And it is the desire of the heart of our Father to give in such a way as to draw us in our poverty and in our frailty into deeper relationship with Him. And as our hearts begin to beat in rhythm with His, it is only natural that we begin to give of ourselves for this same reason. That is, to draw those we encounter nearer to the heart of our gracious, kind Father. Okay, so did Tony get to this list of things to pray for? It's up on the top left. Did you get to that on Saturday? Okay, so it says awareness. Sometimes it's tough just to be aware of what's going on around us. First thing, slow down. Every time I see that, you know, I just get convicted again. Slow down. Pray for. So last week, what were we doing? We wanted to prepare our hearts. We wanted to understand our poverty. We wanted to understand how to be kind, how to be gracious, how to be loving to other people. And in order to do that, we needed to understand our poverty and begin to pray. And we were praying for eyes to see, ears to hear, a heart to empathize, wisdom to discern, eyes to invite, hands to extend, feet to go, not feet go, and stuff to give. And then we are to look and listen, open our hearts, and loosen our grip. So we're going to be looking at the story of Ruth today. But we're going to be talking specifically about the concept of gleaning. So gleaning probably doesn't really mean much to us. Maybe we have a sort of, it's sort of in our language, like if we glean something from something, it means we kind of got something out of it, or we got something just kind of starting to understand it. If you have a conversation with someone, what you remember is kind of what you glean from it, and that's how we use the word. But we're going to be looking at the biblical idea of gleaning. So if you have a Bible, go to Leviticus 19:9. And we're going to go 19:9 through 10. Okay. So these are commands from God to his people, the Israelites. It says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you are not to reap the very edge of your field or gather the gleanings, the stuff that falls down, of your harvest. You might not strip your vineyard bare, you must not strip your vineyard bare, or gather its fallen grapes. Leave them for the poor and the foreign resident. I am Yahweh, your God." So, when God made his covenant, when God made his contract, when God made his relationship with Israel, he said that you will be my people and I will be your God. So he's just given them a command to leave the gleanings of their field. So there should be a box on your notes. That's supposed to be a field in Microsoft Word. So if this is a field, then you have the extra here. So this is the heart and the core of the field, and this is what was to be left to be gleaned. And the reason why it was left to be gleaned is because the roadways would go along this, so that as someone is traveling, you know, from destination to destination, they would be able to take stuff from here and go about their way. Also, if someone was here and they were, you know, a sojourner, a foreigner, or somebody who might have been despised in the community and was poor for some sort of unrighteous reason, if they're right here, right, and they're picking, they're going to be safe because this is a roadway, right? It's just like standing out over here. If you're standing out here, you usually are safe. But if you're standing on a main roadway, you have eyes on you. And so there are witnesses. And so not only is this a command to feed people, it's also a command in sort to protect people. So God is commanding the Israelites to, when they have their harvest, to leave the extra, the stuff by the road, behind. But he also says that when they're going through and harvesting, to not pick it dry. So to intentionally not make as much profit as you would. So this is where all the good stuff is. And he's saying, even the good stuff, leave some of that behind, because this is going to get picked dry. And when you leave, the idea is that once this is picked dry, then you have this inside. But he, like I said, he was banking that. He says at the end of the command, he says that I am Yahweh, your God. So what is he doing? So if we go to Deuteronomy, it has a similar command. So we're going to Deuteronomy 24, 19 through 22. So again, it says, "When you reap the harvest in your field and you forget a sheaf in the field, do not go back to get it." Just don't pick it dry. "It is to be left for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you knock down the fruit from your olive tree, you must not go over the branches again. What remains will be for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you must not glean from what is left. What remains will be for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember, remember, remember what? That you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Remember your poverty. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this." So last week we talked about kindness, and how do we become kind? By recognizing our poverty apart from God, realizing that everything that we have, every breath, stop, breathe, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. I didn't give you that breath. You didn't give you that breath. You're used to it always being there because every time your brain tells your body to breathe, it does it. But you didn't make yourself do it. You didn't sustain yourself. The Bible talks about when we lay to bed at night, when we go to sleep, he sustains us through the night. Right? Some of us have dreams. Some of us don't. Most of us wake up and go, We don't know what's going on. We have no idea what's going on. People die in their sleep all the time. People die in their sleep all the time. You don't. Most of us don't worry about that. Some of us do worry about that. That's another thing for another time. But the point is that we have no control over anything that we have, right? So everything that we have is a gift. And yes, you might have worked for it, but who gave you the ability to work for it? And yes, you might have the degree and the credentials, but who gave you the ability to get the degree and the credentials? There are smarter people than you who are less certified than you because of the circumstances that God has allowed them to be in. That's a fact. And then there are also, conversely, dumber people than you who are more certified than you because of the circumstances that God has allowed you to be in. I've had like 3,500 dreams. She could probably make a list of all the dreams that I've had that get shot down. But I had a dream for a while. I calculated the percentage of my likelihood of getting a tenure-track position teaching philosophy and theology. Like, I calculated that hard. Like, this is what I was going to do. You know, Tony laughed at me now, but this is what I was going to do. All right? So I had it down to a 66.6% if I went to OSU for my undergrad. And then I went to Oxford, you know, in England, across the pond, you know, with all this money that I don't have. If I went to Oxford and then did my master's and my PhD, I had that all worked out. Well, it didn't work out. But I probably could do it, but God hasn't asked me to do it. So God didn't give me the resources to do it. So here I am. He asked me to do this. So I'm here doing this. And he's sustaining me. I could drop dead right now. I don't have any control over it. You don't have any control over it. I could. I pray I don't. Actually, it'd be kind of nice, but it's kind of selfish. So if I do go, put in a good word. But the fact of the matter is that he's saying to Israel, okay, remember that I am your God. And I said, you would be my people. You're my people. My people. What's that mean? He is directing everything in their lives, personally and as a bigger community. If you read the Old Testament, you'll see times when Israel goes to war and just thwomps everyone with like five people and a toothpick or a jawbone of a donkey. And then other times you'll see where there's like if you read Habakkuk, it's like, hey, get ready because you're about to get whooped. Why? Because you're not listening to me. And I love you, and sometimes you get whooped when you get loved. But he says, I am your God and you are my people. So when we're called to remember that, when he asks us to do something, he's not asking us to do something on our own power by ourselves. He's saying, I am God. I am sustaining you right now in this moment. Do this thing. And he's also at the same time calling on his image in us, in our brokenness. He says, remember that you were once slaves in Egypt. Remember what it's like to be destitute. Remember your poverty. So when he says, hey, here's this field. You own this field, but really, I gave you the resources for this field. Okay, so next I'm going to ask you to kind of leave the outsides of this field for those foreigners and those sojourners. Remember those 40 years we wandered in the desert? Wouldn't it have been nice to have some grapes or some olives? Wouldn't it have been nice? So because you remember that, leave some. Take care of the broken among you. But he also says, and then this part, this is the really good part. So it's kind of easy to do this, right? This is like the fluff. Like this is, you know, you might make a little bit of money on this, so go ahead and take whatever you want. But this is the good stuff of the vineyard. This is where all the money is. He says, also, when you go through that, go through once and leave the rest. Go through once. Every American business person in the world is like, why would you do that? Because I'm your God. and you're my people. And God is committed to having us reflect him into the world. And God is the one who said, before the foundations of the world, I loved you, and I predestined you, and I sent my son for you. It's the Father heart of God. This is the Father heart of God. So we're talking about fields, but we're talking about everything other than fields too. So to kind of get what this looks like, to kind of get a picture of what this looks like in their time, turn to Ruth 2. It's after Judges, before Samuel. Super short. You'll probably miss it 35 times unless you've got an app. Got a love-hate relationship with sticky notes. So, funny story, I used to do IT, and I don't have an iPad. Tony doesn't know how to use a computer, and he has an iPad. That's weird. Okay. So, if you flip this handy-dandy paper over, you're going to see the thing that you just prayed or ought to have been praying for last week, the thing we walked to and reflected on, conveniently lines up with the story of Ruth. It's almost like we planned it, except we didn't, except God did. So I'm going to start reading. It says, so for some context, okay, real quick, context of the story of Ruth. A lot of people who are familiar with the story of Ruth are familiar because it's taught as like a really cool love story. And basically, Boaz, the main guy in the story, is sort of like this love-stricken dude who's like doing all these nice things because that's what love-stricken dudes do, and that's what Christian love-stricken dudes do too. But in reality, Boaz is just a genuinely good person. So what has happened is Ruth, who the story is the main protagonist? Is that what the main person in the story is called? Protagonist is the person who, like, bugs him. Anyone? Is it antagonist is the main character and protagonist, or antagonist is the one that goes after? Thank Anne, against. Yeah, I got it. Okay, thanks. See, someone smarter than me in the room. Thank goodness. So, Ruth's the main character of the story. And what's happened is she's become a widow. So, in these times, typically what would happen is someone would be widowed and then someone from the family would swoop in and take over responsibility for providing for, protecting for the family. Someone, it's called a kinsman redeemer, they would come in from the family and take care of them. Well, Ruth had a mother-in-law, and this mother-in-law, when her son died, was full of despair at the tragedy of the loss of her son. So Ruth and Orpah, two sisters, under the mother-in-law, were told by the mother-in-law, Naomi, hey, get out of here. Like, I'm going to go to Moab. The land of Moab is not a safe place for Israelites. They're not usually welcoming to our people. I'm going to go there. I'm in despair. I'm distraught. I want to go be alone. Just go. It'll be better for you to find a kinsman redeemer here in Bethlehem, which is where they were. Just stay here. And Orpah says, all right, peace, and she leaves. She leaves with her mother-in-law's blessing. But Ruth says, no, I'm going to go with you, and you're going to be my mother-in-law, and your God is going to become my God. So Ruth takes on going to Moab, this place that's not great for the Israelites to be in, for Jews to be in. She's going to go there. So they arrive. And here we are in Ruth 2. Now Naomi, Ruth's mother-in-law, had a relative on her husband's side named Boaz. He was a prominent man of noble character from Elimelech's family. So he was a prominent man of noble character. So when we read about Boaz, take off if you have any preconceived notions about Boaz being this guy who's just in love and acting on it. Take those off. This is how the guy acts to everyone who he interacts with. This is who he is. Now, Boaz is going to be a really helpful guide for us. So he's a prominent man of noble character from Elimelech's family. Ruth, the Moabites, asked Naomi. No, the Moabites. Ooh, what a word. The Moabites asked Naomi, "Will you let me go into the field and gather fallen grain behind someone who allows me to?" So they rolled up in Moab with no plan. So Ruth is like, okay, well, we got to eat. So Naomi, will you let me go out into some field and pluck some grain just so we can eat? She says, Naomi answered her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So Ruth left and entered the field to gather grain behind the harvesters. She happened to be in the portion of land belonging to Boaz, who is from Elimelech's family. Now, this happened. So the story of Ruth, the only way that you see God's involvement, right, is if you step back and look at the story as a whole. Oh, so she just happened to go into Boaz's field. Just happened to, right? It's the God who is, "You will be my people and I will be your God." Just happened that way. So Ruth left and entered the field to gather grain behind the harvesters. She happened to be in the portion of land belonging to Boaz. So there'd be a field here, and then there'd be a field here, and then there'd be a field down here, and over here, and over here, and over there, and there'd be different people's fields, and she just happened to roll into that field. Something about that field. And it says, later, when Boaz arrived from Bethlehem, he said to the harvesters, "The Lord be with you." Boaz asked his servant who was in, and then they said, "The Lord bless you," they replied. So real quick, so the relationship that Boaz had with his servants, as we're gonna see as it goes on, he didn't owe them anything. He didn't owe them God's blessings. They were working for him. He owed them a paycheck. Basically, he owed them food and a place to stay. That's all he owed him. But he was the kind of man who would roll up and say, "Bless you." And everyone would say, "Bless you," right back. So the kind of relationship he had, he saw each person as valuable. He saw each person as valuable. So he rolls up and he says, "Hey, bless you guys." And they say, "Hey, bless you." And then as he's blessing them, Boaz asked his servant who was in charge of the harvesters, "Whose young woman is this?" So, eyes to see. So, Boaz knows. So, think about this, okay? So, you're a guy. He's coming from Bethlehem. You're a guy. You got a field. It's being worked by your harvesters. You're pretty hands-off. You don't have to be hands-on, right? But Boaz is hands-on. So hands-on that his people love him. They respond with blessing back to him. You know, the Old Testament had all kinds of rules to protect those who were servants, had all kinds of rules. If a servant ran away and someone found them, that servant was considered free. Why? Because if you were treating your servant in such a way that they had to run away, obviously the person in charge is doing something wrong. You got to protect them. But he was the kind of person where he would bless them and they would bless him back. He would bless them and they would bless him back. So he's already got that kind of relationship, but then he comes to the field and he doesn't just notice his servants. He notices the foreigner, the foreign girl, the girl who's not usually there. He knows what poor person is picking in his field. He has eyes to see. He doesn't just care about his field and his money. He cares about his servants. And he doesn't just care about his field and his servants. He cares about the people that are coming along the roads and picking in his field in desperation. He cares about them. He has eyes to see. So as we read on, the servant answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. She asked, 'Will you let me gather fallen grain among the bundles behind the harvesters?' She came and has remained from early morning until now, except that she has rested a little in the shelter." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen, my daughter." So he goes up to her. So he hears this story. Okay, he hears this story. You're going to see it now. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen, my daughter. Don't go and gather grain in another field. And don't leave this one. But stay here close to my female servants. See which field they are harvesting and follow them. Haven't I ordered the young men not to touch you? When you are thirsty, go and drink from the jars the young men have filled." Can anyone tell me why he said, "When you're thirsty, go get a drink from the jars the young men filled"? Anyone? Boaz listened. He knew. His servant said, "She hasn't rested all day except for one little break." He listened. He didn't just listen to what was being said. He thought of what was being said. He thought about what that meant. He thought about what was being said. If she only took a little rest, she's not healthy. She's not getting the water she needs. She probably didn't know who to ask for. She just wandered into this field, and thankfully they let her glean. She doesn't even know what's going on, so she just rested in a resting place for a moment, too afraid to ask anybody for water, too afraid that she would lose her right to pick from that field, that she'd ask for too much, that she'd be a burden, too afraid. And he hears how this woman worked and how it wasn't good for her. And he heard that she wasn't taking breaks, and he says, "Come to my field. You see, wherever my servants are, these are my servants. If you see them, you are as good as they are." She wasn't. He didn't owe her anything. They didn't have a contract. He didn't have to do anything for her. But Boaz was a man of noble character, and he had eyes to see, and he had ears to hear, and he hears this woman's struggle. And he says, "Come, follow my female servants." When he's putting her with her female servants, they're in here. They're where the good stuff is. That's where the servants are. They're plucking the good stuff, the choice stuff. He invites her from out here all the way into here in 0.4 seconds because he has eyes to see and ears to hear. He knows that she's working hard. He knows her story, and he has compassion on her. So he invites her in for protection, and he says, "Come, follow my servants. Wherever they go, you follow them. And don't you worry. If you go to take a break, you're fine. You'll be welcome back. You don't have to ask permission. Don't worry about people from the street grabbing you and taking you off, because my men will protect you. Don't worry about my people, because they will love you as I have loved you. They will protect you." And it goes on. She bowed with her face to the ground and said to him, "Why are you so kind to notice me? Why are you so..." I'm using my translation because I love this. What does it say in the NIV? Does it say kind in the NIV? "Why have I found such favor?" Right. "Why have I found such favor? Why are you so kind?" Kindness is giving folks favor they don't deserve. "So why have I found such favor? Why are you being so kind to me, although I am a foreigner? Although I belong out here, why are you interested in me?" And no, remember, take off these blinders. He's not in love. He's just listened to her story. This is who he is. And he says, Boaz answered her, "Everything that you have done for your mother-in-law since your husband's death..." Pause. Okay, when we read the scriptures, we just go, "Oh yeah, everything that happens that you've done for your mother-in-law, since your father's death, just phrase over it." Anybody lose somebody in their life? You don't just phrase over it. You don't just read over it. This is recent in their lives, right? This is a recent choice. She's working in pain. It might be subtle pain, it might be in those quiet moments, but she's working in that pain. And she's working for a woman that she didn't even have to work for. This woman told her to go. Stay, I'm going to go. That's who she's working for. And oh my goodness, time flies by. So he's listening to this story, right? He's listening to this story. And everything that you have done for your mother-in-law since your husband's death has been fully reported to me. How you left your father and mother and the land of your birth, and how you came to a people you didn't previously know. A heart to empathize. Can you imagine what it would be like to lose your soulmate, your best part of you? And then, in your brokenness, to choose to go with your mother-in-law, who's broken, by the way, over the same death of your soulmate, and then to choose to go into discomfort for her sake. I don't think Boaz is the only person a noble character in this story. But she's poor, but she's destitute, but she's a foreigner. Yeah, so is Boaz. So am I. So I've heard everything that you've done. I said, may the Lord reward you for what you have done, and may you receive a full reward from the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. Remember, she said that your God will be my God. God says, I will be your God and you will be my people. God is meeting her needs through Boaz. Says, my Lord, she said, you have been so kind to me, for you have comforted and encouraged your slave, although I am not like one of your female servants. At mealtime, Boaz told her, come over here and have bread and dip it in the vinegar sauce. So she sat beside the harvesters and she offered a roasted grain. She ate and was satisfied and had some left over. So Boaz has this field. And he doesn't use this field as if it's his. He uses this field as if it's God's. And he doesn't look at his servants as if they're his. He looks at his servants as if they're God's. And he doesn't look at the foreigners, the impoverished people, as if they're foreigners and impoverished people. He looks at them as if they're God's. This is his livelihood. No. This is his field. No. God is his livelihood, and this is God's field. Let me say that again. This is his livelihood. No. This is his field. No. God is his livelihood, and God is his field. Because if this is his livelihood, he can't give it away, because he needs it to survive. If God is his source of life, he can give anything away, because God is what sustains his life. And if we are clutching onto the things that we have, if we are clutching onto our time, if we are acting like our bodies are ours, we can't give any of it away. But if we recognize that God is sustaining us, that God has given us a finite number of hours, that God has given us everything that we have, how can we hold on to it? Now, the intention isn't that you become poor, right? Because if you read it, it says, you know, to leave this on the outside, which we discuss is kind of the bad stuff anyway. And when you go through here, by all means, I don't have to bet you very much money that those people were really whacking those vines to make sure that they got what was ready to come off, right? And God knows that. God, when God gives us a command, he knows who we are, right? He knows who we are. But at the same time, here's Boaz, and Boaz is saying, hang on, if God is the one who's providing for me, and if God has given me this field, and if God has given me these servants, and if God has had this woman go through this stuff, then who am I to keep her from sharing in the bounty that God has given me? Boaz gives because Boaz has been given. And Boaz has kindness and love for those who are impoverished because Boaz knows that apart from God, he is impoverished. So Boaz has eyes to see because Boaz knows that God had eyes to see him and his people. And Boaz looks back on Egypt and knows that God had ears for his people. And Boaz looks at the 40-year journey that they took and knows that God can and does provide everything. So Boaz says, "I see you. Come here. I know you shouldn't be here, but come here." I'm going to show you something really interesting that happens too. So she sat beside the harvesters, and he offered her roasted grain. I'm in verse 14. She ate and was satisfied and had some left over. She ate and was satisfied and had some on the edges left over. When she got up to gather grain, Boaz ordered his young men, "Let her gather grain among the bundles and don't humiliate her." Don't what? Humiliate her. Give in such a way to keep her dignity. Keep her dignity. See, emphasize here, or empathize here. Give in such a way to honor her dignity. Her what? Her dignity. But she's a foreigner. But she doesn't have anything to offer. But he doesn't owe her anything. Oh, but I'm a sinner. But I don't have anything to offer. My best works are rags. But he what? He gave his son for us while we were yet what? Sinners. What is Boaz doing? Boaz is doing what God is always doing. God has stuff, and he invites us to share in the joy that God gets from giving his stuff. Anything that you have is not so that you can have the stuff. It's so that you can have the Father heart of God, that your heart and God's heart can beat in the same rhythm. Because God delights to give. Give to who? Certainly his servants. Certainly us. But just as much to the foreigner, to the person who's coming into our lives. And if you and I are so busy, then we don't have a second to hear your story. I'm sorry, my life. What? My life? What? My life is more important. Whose life is it? It's God's. So if we're too busy to have time for those around us, what are we doing wrong? Or living for ourselves? And if our budget is so strapped, pending genuine circumstances where you got to work 8 jobs just to survive because of some bad choices you made or some bad hands that you were dealt, pending those two things, most of us aren't there. Most of us aren't there. But there are seasons and there are times when you need to work 80 hours just to survive. But then, what do you take with you in those 80 hours? You take your heart. You take your eyes to see. You take your ears to hear. You can be neck deep in whatever, concrete, and still listen to someone. But if we're living at the margins of our life, if we're living so maxed out that to have us, you know, can I have 10 minutes of your time? No. Again, 10 minutes of whose time? God's. So this is a perspective shift. Take it from the field to your life. You probably don't have a field, but you have something. You do something. You spend your day something. Something pays the bills. Okay? So you have that. So look at the field and then look at your life and look at your life and realize that everything that you have is a gift. So I want to look at what Ruth does, and then you guys will pray. You and Jerry will have to come up and do your thing. But I'm going to look at Ruth's life. And look what she does. So she gathered, don't rebuke her. So she gathered grain in the field until evening, 17. She beat out what she had gathered, and it was 26 quarts of barley, way more than she would have got. way more than she deserved, way more than she was entitled to, kind of like grace. Kind of like the grace God gives us in sustaining us and forgiving us. I did it again, you're forgiven. I did it again, you're forgiven. I did it again, you're forgiven. She's given more than she deserved, more than she even imagined, kind of like grace, because he's a good, good father. It says, she picked up the grain and went into town where her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. Then she brought out what? She brought out what she had left over from her meal and gave it to her. If you remember the earlier text, it says, Ruth ate until she was satisfied. What? Her needs were met. Her genuine needs were met. And then she had extra. So what does she do with the extra? She gives it to Naomi. Just like Boaz was making enough to meet ends meet. He was making enough to meet his needs. And everything else, it's yours. It's God's. Someone's in my field today. That someone is going to get everything. Look at her character. Look at the way that she's loving her mother-in-law. How could I not give what God has given to me to her when she's in need? Elsewhere in Scripture, 2 Corinthians 8, Paul talks about the way in which we're to give. And he's talking about an example when a church actually gave more than they ought to have. They gave until they didn't actually have all their needs met. They were willing to sacrifice basic needs for the sake. And what Paul says is that this isn't the way you're supposed to give. The way that you're supposed to give is each person is supposed to have enough. So that in your excess, you give of your excess. You give of your excess. In your excess, he's implying that what you need is meetable. And then for everything after what you need, you give it away. That's why you have it. You have it because the Father heart of God is to give away the excess, to give, to overflow, to bubble over into others. So when he calls you to give, he calls you in line with him to see and feel and know the joy of giving and to see and feel the joy of being given to. You know, Jesus says it's better to give than receive. Why? Because God, the ultimate good, the ultimate better, gives. The best good that you can do is to mimic God. And God gives so that we can give. Now, there's two people in this story. I'll wrap it up. There's two people in the story. There's the person who's able to give, and then there's the person who's being given to. So there are times and there are seasons when we are one of the two. So, you know, when we were getting ready to get married, I had to pay two rents. I worked 1.5 billion hours. It was crazy. Okay, we had to get a car thrown together. She was working like part-time. It was a really, really crazy season for us. We didn't have time because I needed what? She needed a place to stay. I needed a place to stay. We weren't going to live together because that's not what you do. So we were trying to honor God. And in order to honor God, I had to sacrifice my time. But in a way, I was sacrificing my time for her. If I had been living on the margins, I wouldn't have had time to give to her. So that's the thought I'm going to leave you with. Where in your life are you living as if everything that you have, time, wealth, health, is yours instead of God's? Think about that. And where in your life are you living on the margins, pushing everything out to the end so that if anyone comes to take from you, it destroys you because you don't have anything to give, or you give out of stuff that you can't afford, or you put yourself in this position. So think about how you don't have a field, but what is your field, or what are your fields? I'm going to pray. Father, I thank you that you love us, and that you love us in such a way as to give when we don't deserve it, as to give what we don't deserve exactly when we don't deserve it. I thank you that you are the God who invites us to partake in the joy of giving. I pray that you would work in our hearts, that you would give us eyes to see ourselves as we really are, desperately in need and desperately having our needs met by you and in you and through you. And I pray that as we go about this week, that we would have eyes to see, that we would have a heart to empathize, that we would have ears to hear, that we would slow down, and that we would loosen our grip, not because we're trying to muscle our way to you, but because we see that everything that we have is a gift from you. In Jesus' name.